Hey, everybody, and welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. You'll notice that it's a roundtable, but it's a little bit more square. Wade McFall is on much-deserved PTO time, and we've got a special guest. We've been trying to bring guests in on some of our OIG roundtables just to change it up a little bit and get some different perspectives. Of course, this week, as always, I've got my two compadres, Jason Eisengrind, retired senior executive from HHS OIG, and the retired Western UPIC director, Matt Kachansky, also a counterpart to Jason as a senior executive at HHS OIG, and the retired Northeast UPIC director. And I looked at my driver's license this morning, and I still am Eric Rubenstein. I have not been put in witness protection, and I am still the senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse here at Advise. Today, we have a great guest on, and I'm really excited to have this guest on. It's Noel Neal. Noel, I'm going to let you introduce yourself in a minute, but, you know, I often say that sometimes LinkedIn is the Tinder for professionals. I have met more people on LinkedIn and have developed professional and working relationships with so many people on LinkedIn. Noel is one of them. We connected up about a year or two ago. He is an expert in the DME space. We're going to get to you in a second about that background. But Noel and I have exchanged emails, chat, LinkedIn messages for a while, and I'm really excited to have you on, Noel, because obviously the DME space is one that is constantly under scrutiny, and you provide a really good perspective. So, Noel, I'm going to turn it over to you. Tell us about you, your business, what you do, and, you know, let's get going.
Great. Thanks for having me. And with such a distinguished panelist, these folks, the combined experience you guys have on this group with Matt and Jason is just amazing. Followed your podcast, known these guys vicariously, I feel like, for years through you, Eric. Great group of guys. I'm happy to be here. So my name is, as Eric mentioned, is Noel Neal. I'm the Vice President of Corporate Compliance and Auditing at AccuServe. And AccuServe is one of the largest DME billing and consulting firm there is. So we represent multiple suppliers across the spectrum, from, you know, small providers to medium to large providers that are part of hospital system. So because of that, we get to see the full gamut of the billing and compliance and documentation perspective from DME suppliers. I've been in the industry maybe about 15 to 20 years. I've done everything from intake all the way to billing to compliance. So I pretty much understand the intricacy. I've worked for a supplier, so I understand the challenges of the grueling process of calling doctors and asking them for documentation. Back in the days when all you needed was a prescription, it seems, and we've become so audit-centric now, where no supplier dispenses an item without having all the documentation. You cannot just rely on doctors anymore. So I am members of various councils, Medicare advisory groups, part of the Medicare Provider and Outreach and Education Advisory Group for all of the DME MACs. I'm also members of the council, and the council is made up of stakeholders. And we meet with Medicare, the DME MAC contractors, on a quarterly basis to kind of just talk about different things on the, where that is concerned. So I'm a part of that, various industry advisory groups and different things, very involved and entrenched in all things DME. I've represented multiple DME suppliers through various audits, RAC certs, TPE, SMRC, and appeal all the way up to the ALJs and the DAB, dealt with extrapolated cases. So very entrenched and involved with the audit. I've done countless hours of education for suppliers, continuing education, compliance-related education, documentation requirements. So heavily invested in the DME space and often called to testify subject matter experts at ALJ cases regarding DME rules and regulations and documentation requirements. So a mouthful there.
Yeah, no, you've got a great background, and you really are a subject matter expert. And you know, you threw out all of the alphabet soup of healthcare fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance. And so we want to spend the half hour or 40 minutes that we typically do for these podcasts really talking about all of these nuanced issues that are out there and that intersection that exists in the DME space from a fraud, waste, abuse, compliance, and proper billing and coding perspective. The very first thing that I want to talk to you about is the recent CMS guidance that came out I want to say it was in January, but it might have been a little bit before, a little bit after, regarding some of the changes in some of the documentation requirements, particularly with what are known as the CMNs and the DIFs. So first, if you can provide just a simple definition of what a CMN is and what a DIF is, and then we can kind of go from there.
Absolutely. Great question. And these are changes that we're super excited about. I think this all started with the CMNs during the PHE. So the CMN, Certificate of Medical Necessity, it is a document that is completed by the physician. There's information elements that are extrapolated from the local coverage determination to determine whether or not an item is covered. For example, the old oxygen policy would have a section on the CMN that asks for the oxygen saturation test that would have to be supported by the medical records. The PIM makes it clear that the DIFs are not a replacement of medical records. In fact, they need to be corroborated by the information. But basically what it did, it collates the information in a form-like manner where data elements are populated and that information is transmitted electronically to the DME MACs, and they're able to use those data points to determine whether or not a piece of DME equipment is reasonable and necessary. We've come a very long way. A lot of DME items required CMNs or DIF at some point in time, but over years, CMS have phased them out. And the final remaining product categories that required DIF and CMN has been phased out recently, as you mentioned. So CMNs are completed and signed by the doctor. The DIFs are a little bit different. The document information form, which is really completed by the supplier. So it's the same concept, though. The supplier will take the information from the patient's medical records and fill out information. For example, the enteral or parenteral required a DIF. It asks for the amount of calories per day and so on, information that the suppliers will pull from the records, input it, and then that will transmit electronically to the supplier. So, you know, they're just forms, really. I know at first when we had asked for this is because, it really was a form that had to be corroborated by the medical records, right? But it was still an important form to the point where, Eric, and you probably will chuckle at this, I had a case once that I went to an ALJ judge. The patient's medical records overwhelmingly supports that the patient needed oxygen, but there was an error made on the form and the supplier just, the doctor strike a line through the form, didn't initial and date it. And that claim went all the way up to the ALJ. And the argument, I mean, the judge really just snuffed at it and said, you know, basically it's going to be favorable because he's like, well, the evidence is in the medical records, but just because this form wasn't completed in a particular way, the claim reaches there. And I understand the MACs, the RACs, the QUICs are limited to those claims processing guidelines. So it really was an unintended consequence. And it's not like right. Someone intentionally caused it to be there. So for us, it's really a welcome change, not having that form. We still, nothing changed in terms of the coverage requirement for these policies. It's just that this document is not required to be submitted. So we essentially were happy about the CMN. And I think our ask CMS was to get rid of the CMN because the doctor had to complete it. But then CMN went ahead and said, we're just going to get rid of DIF as well. And we were like, wait a minute, we didn't want that because that was supplier created. We could create it at any point in time. And it was a good utility for us to transmit certain information to Medicare, the amount of calories the patients are using, the method of administration, and so on. So we were worried, to be honest, as an industry, we were worried that now we lose the ability to transmit this information, that it will result in more claim denial or more audits. Because now Medicare is just relying on the supplier to submit the quantity. There's no checks and balances anymore. But I'm happy to say that we've gone through this transition without an itch. The claims are processing as we expect them to, and it has not resulted in any increased audits or denials. We had one supplier that had an issue because they would normally indicate on the DIF that a particular criteria isn't met, and that would result in an automatic denial. But I think with some re-education, that supplier quickly learned that there's still a utility within the policy to allow that. And coupled with that, what CMS also did is they've added the KX, the GZ, the GA modifier to those policies that will be in effect in a couple of weeks, July 1st to be exact. That will automatically give you a a liability denial if you choose not to complete the DIF correctly or the information from the DIF. So we're happy about the change, super happy about the CMNs, but we'll take the DIF as well, especially since it's not causing any problem.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, so it's interesting when you talked about that example with the line strike without the initial, it's really like, you know, we would almost look at that from the OIG perspective as a technical violation, right? It's almost like a medical record that's completed, but the provider fails to sign the medical record. And, you know, that's a denial that is really, it's a technical denial that is overcome. And I think Matt and Jason would agree that like cases like that, where these technical violations occur, where otherwise would be overturned or wouldn't be looked at, become part of that burden of having to, you know, to deal with that. So, but Matt, I want to go to you now, because one of the things that, you know, in the lack of needing a CMN and a DIF now for some things, and I think our viewers and listeners need to understand that CMNs and DIFs have not gone away in their totality. It's a finite list of things that no longer require CMNs and DIFs. There are some things in the DME space that still need that. And at the end of the day, it's documentation. And from an investigative perspective, we would always say that, you know, the more paper that's out there about something, the better it is, right? Because that's going to help to show you things like your intent or your malfeasance, or, you know, turning a blind eye. So Matt, I want to go to you first, because right from Noel's perspective, CMNs and DIF going away are a great thing because it helps to streamline billing, coding, and payment. But at the same time, from an investigative perspective, hey, those are two pieces of paper that we would have wanted to have had in front of us, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Anytime you can find documentation where an objective third party, such as the prescribing doctor, is saying this person needs this equipment or this nutrition infusion in this amount, and because of all of these things, that is absolutely good evidence that what is being provided is medically necessary. It's not the DME company saying it. It's substantially a, you know, objective party that's saying that. So that type of evidence is absolutely needed to validate or not the allegations that the UPIC or the OIG are investigating.
So Noel, to go back to that point with you, so with CMNs and DIFs not being a requirement for some things, what sort of instruction are you giving to your clients about, you know, in the absence of having to have these, you still want to have something, you know, right? Because even though you may not need them for the purposes of submitting a claim, you still want to make sure, you know, I like to use the phrase, the belt and suspenders approach. I think I got that from somebody that trained me as a new agent. But you oftentimes want to have this belt and suspenders approach, particularly in your field, which is a field that gets an inordinate amount of scrutiny, because there is a lot of fraud in the DME field. So what are you, is there anything particular that you've been instructing your clients?
So that's a good point, Eric. And I also just wanted to go back and just to clarify what CMS did finally, though, is all the remaining product categories that require DIF and CMN, they've eliminated them. So for any new setups moving forward, DIFs or CMN are no longer required. However, anything prior to the eliminations of the DIF and CMN, if you were to be audited on an older claim, which oftentimes is what, you know, the UPICs will do, the certs and so on, suppliers are still responsible to produce that document. But more to your point, Eric, we always encourage supplier, even when those forms were required, to make sure that information is memorialized within the progress notes, because the PIM makes it clear that CMNs and orders, they're not considered medical records. And sometimes people get carried away where they see the CMN and having all these elements where the doctor checks it off, and they're like, oh, we're golden. And then when we do the audit of the file, we're like, well, the doctor says that the patient has COPD, but it's not mentioned anywhere in the progress notes. So that information is not even worth the paper it's written on, right? So, you know, we continue to hammer home the point that make sure that your documentation supports the item you're furnishing. Make sure your progress notes, make sure you have prescription. So in light of these items being eliminated, our education has consistently been the same. document, document, document. Because there's this philosophy, it wasn't documented, it wasn't done. No matter how much you think that it was appropriate, if it wasn't properly documented in the medical records, then it's not done in the event of an audit.
Well, you know, and what makes DME a little bit different from, you know, the traditional medical services is oftentimes I think that providers are documenting to the service that they're rendering, but they're not always coding to that service, right? You know, so, you know, we've had clients here at Advisor. I talk to the doctor who says, well, you know, I'm documenting for the things that I did. I said, okay, great, but you're coding for something entirely different. And I always use as my reference that there's a 360 degree view, right? It's you've got to document to the treatment and then code to the documentation. Because at the end of the day, the MACs, the UPICs, the OIG, commercial payers, Medicaid, nobody cares really what you did to the patient relative to what was documented, you know, to that. You know, and it always gives me the example I always like to give was when I was mentoring a new agent, we went to a house one day to go. It was an ambulance case. And we got to the house and the house was on a hill and there were a number of flights of stairs, no ramp, just a number of flights of stairs to get to the house. And so I said to the new agent, doesn't this give you pause? It's an ambulance case. There's no ramp. The person is allegedly homebound or bedbound. And we got to the top of the stairs and on the porch was a motorized wheelchair that was outside the house. And that was an ambulance case. And he was a new agent. And I said, like, make a note of this because now you're going to have to look at the DME piece of this because the wheelchair has to be able to be used in the home. It's not a scooter that you rent from, you know, one of the rideshare apps. But even more than that is that even if they were using the scooter outside, the motorized wheelchair outside of their house, how are they getting it? Like, how is it getting from point A to point B? And so, you know, we went back and, we did look at some medical records and found that the supplier had fabricated some records because they had indicated taking one of the things right in the wheelchair space is measurements. Does the chair fit in the door? Because the chair is supposed to be used for home use. So that documentation really, you know, it is a very important, you know, piece of that puzzle. So, Jason, I want to go to you now because, you know, Noel's talking about, with these changes in policy and the lack of documentation needed and some of these technical violations where he talks about, you know, the fact that a line was crossed out and the case still managed to go all the way up to the ALJ level. And we've talked in previous podcasts, Jason, about the thin resources that exist. From a UPIC perspective and from your perspective as someone who was running, you know, a large UPIC, what challenges are then presented with some technical violation that actually is something that, you know, the program integrity manual, the PIM says, in order to submit a claim or the claims processing manual says, in order to submit a claim, it's got to have these things. And when one of those things is missing, but is really like a technical violation, how do you deal with that push pull that's going to exist from that resource allocation perspective?
Well, unfortunately, you're probably going to deal with it after the fact, right? Because prior to the investigation being conducted, you're not going to necessarily know that, oh, well, this was just a technical violation. So at some point, there's an investment of resources. And if there are technical violations, they certainly need to be addressed. And there are a lot of different ways that that can happen. But the reality is the Unified Program Integrity Contractor, so the UPIC, the primary goal is to ensure the integrity of the program, obviously. And it's not to say that a technical violation doesn't fall into the auspices of program integrity, but the real meat and potatoes of it is looking for, gee, isn't it interesting that at this address, in a particular service area, you know, there are 300 patients that all received insert name of DME there. You know, it's those types of things that stick out, no pun intended, like a sore thumb. And so I would be interested if I could ask Noel. So when you When you talk to providers, DME providers, do you speak about things like that, like things that just are aberrant on their very surface, like where, you know, there's a senior housing center and everybody's getting a particular piece of equipment, like those things? Okay. Yeah, I'm always curious because it's, you know, those are the easy targets.
Right.
And, you know, and they're also going to be the ones that, you know, frankly, you know, are very near and dear to not just the UPIC, but to the OIG. And I just would also say, it'll be interesting. The doctors are the gatekeepers. So the more the gatekeepers are distanced from that claim, I guess I'm just old fashioned. I'm going to want to see, what does it look like after 2 or 3 years of operation like that? Because I just have seen way too many times where, you know, the gatekeeper is either complicit or an unwilling co-conspirator, you know, in the situation. So I'm not so sure I, from a consumer, appreciate the some of those changes, but I guess time will tell whether they were effective or not.
Right. So, you know, to your point, and I think that's a very good point, Jason, and I know we want to get into some really heated conversation about some trends and so on, but just wanted to add a really quick point to the comment. So with regards to the CMNs and DIF, these were just basic utilities, right, for claim processing. The requirements has always been for that doctor to still document the medical need. So in that sense, the doctors are still the one who should ultimately make the determination of it's being reasonable and necessary. What was happening is, from a practical standpoint, why this came about? We're in the public health emergency, right? In 2020, nobody really truly understood what COVID was. Well, we have a doctor who have a patient on a hospital to be discharged, but then a supplier is holding up discharge of that oxygen just because this form is not completed. Now, the medical records that is contained within the progress notes supports overwhelmingly that the oxygen is reasonable and necessary, but just this administrative process of the form makes it impossible for us to move forward. The same challenge is when you have rotation hospital. The progress notes from the clinician supports it, but it's to get someone to sign that one form. So, you know, it just didn't make sense for that administrative process to delay coordination of care and someone having to stay in the hospital an extra day or two just because a form cannot be signed, when there's already a prescription for the item, medical records to support it, it meets substantial compliance with the published regs, then there's really no need. So I think from that perspective, it's a positive thing, but I totally appreciate the position that you take also as the doctor being that gatekeeper. That's a good point.
Yeah, the balance between access to care and program integrity is one that, you know, we walk that line every day as well as all the providers do. But in DME, it seems that the access to care during the COVID PHE, when they waived all of the enrollment requirements for the DME companies, and then all of a sudden, you know, there were 4,000 new DME companies and, you know, 2,000 of them were in Broward County, Florida.
For the record, Matt, this is something that us as industry stakeholder did not agree with, just so you know, for the record. That waiving of the requirements is not something that we felt was necessary to meet the supply demand. And it was just not something that we support. There's a lot of the other waivers that we did support to relax some of the rules to allow for, you know, timely provision of certain cares that are necessary. But that was just not one that the industry stakeholders did support.
Yeah. And that's an interesting one, right? Because, so, you know, typically, you know, one would presume that a rationale for that waiver would be because the current needs of the community aren't being met, right? Like, skilled nursing facilities need to demonstrate a communal need to get a license in the state and then to get approved by CMS, right? And so there would be this presumption that by doing that, that there was some communal need that wasn't being met. But now what we, you know, what we then get, which is kind of the last piece of what we want to talk about in the last few minutes we have, is this, that explosion And then the collateral consequences of all of the fraud in the telefraud. We won't call it telemedicine because there's a real definitive differentiator between a legitimate telemedicine visit and these telefraud. Correct. From our perspective, and I'll speak on behalf of Jason and Matt, but I think from our perspective, the biggest thing was the fact that there was no longer a requirement to have an established doctor-patient relationship during the PHE for the provision of things like DME. And I still will say that that is one of the biggest linchpin problems that we had, because now, you know, if someone needs a piece of DME, let's say they actually need a knee brace, I'm not really sure how a telemedicine visit can adequately address a patient Correct. Need for a knee brace. And then even more so is the kind of the secondary collateral consequences. If the patient needs a piece of DME that's not an off-of-the-shelf product, how does someone in a telemedicine visit get a custom-made orthotic brace Right. when there is no prior patient relationship? So, you know, the PHE in some regards, I think, Right. you know, a guy that mentored me used to say that the biggest fight that I'll ever have in my career will always be with CMS. It'll never be with a defense attorney. It'll always be with CMS because they want to give the money away and the OIG wants to keep the money. And I think that there's a level of truth to that, that, you know, you always kind of see that during the PHE, there was a really positive intent, right? Mm-hmm. To do the right thing. Continuity of care, as Matt said, the continuity of access to care. But right. with those things comes fraud because, right. you know, the vault has now been opened, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, where do you see, like, you know, that intersection is huge. And we could probably talk for hours about this.
I agree. Yeah. And you know, it's very interesting that you mentioned that because, you know, CMS's biggest concern is access to care, right? And that's sort of the crutch that they fall on when they relax some of these rules and regulations, right? And certainly, I would say that I've seen a lot of positive things from the relaxed telehealth for allowing patients to be evaluated within their home when they have an established relationship. I see particular benefits in things like CPAP, right? You may be evaluated initially, but during the PHE, there's a 90-day reevaluation component. Well, most of the time what the doctor does is look at the download and ask you questions. Well, that is something that can be done through the internet now. You can download it virtually from the reader. You can ask the patient if they're benefiting from it. So certainly there are benefits to that. But as you said, there's always those people that are opportunistic, and that's why the UPICs and the other program integrity contractor plays a vital role, because oftentimes they're really not the smartest people that are doing this. They keep on doing the same thing over and over. So there's oftentimes a pattern that can be identified with the aberrancy of their billing pattern because they're doing the same thing over and over. But to your point, you know, there's a lot of things, a lot of people just ran with a lot of the different things. And I wish we had time to talk about some of these waivers and some of the things that we're seeing. But essentially when Brace Yourself happened, a lot of the providers who switched from that went into CGM. And as you guys probably are aware, that the CGM policy is one of those policies that were relaxed during the PHE. Well, that has some unintended consequences. The CGM utilization almost quadrupled during the PHE when things like oxygens or vents have not seen that significant increase, right? So there's going to be a lot of scrutiny from the OIG perspective, I'm sure, and different auditing entities. I'm hearing horror stories from some of my clients where patients are saying CGM just showed up at their door. They don't know the doctor who prescribed it. So this comes back to your point, Eric, about the telehealth. Patients don't know these doctors who supposedly did telehealth evaluation, complete some formatted templated progress notes, and now the patient has CGM being delivered by a company they've never dealt with every month. And
so explain, not everybody's going to know what a CGM is. Explain what a CGM is, because that's actually an issue, because that creates a whole other discussion. But explain to people who may not know what CGM is, because that actually helps to explain, like, what's out there.
Sure. So, you know, since 2017, Medicare has actually recognized CGM is just the acronym for continuous glucose monitoring, right? For those that have been diabetic, my dad was diabetic. The only way to get your readings were to prick your finger, put your blood on that strip, the reagent, and then put it in the meter, and it tells you the readings. Well, what CGM does, it's something that is placed on the skin, and it reads your blood sugar continuously. There's different technology that had varying functionality, but essentially that's basically what it does. So you no longer have to prick your finger. It's on you continuous, as the name continuous suggests, and it displays your results. It can be done through a device, or it can be even done remotely by your doctor where they're looking at your readings and if your blood sugar. The technology has evolved to the point where it's integrated with insulin pump, where if your sugar goes above a certain amount, it triggers the insulin device to release a certain amount of insulin. So it's a great technology, a really lovely technology for people that are diabetic, whether it's type 1 or type 2, insulin treated or not.
Right.
But to your point is there are all these people that are just opportunists. They're looking at ways in which they can just make a lot of money. And the CGM have very stringent requirements and follow-up requirements every 6 months. And oftentimes what we're starting to see that there are people that are not adhering to those rules. They're just dispensing CGM. So we're going to see a lot more audits there. I have patients who call my local supplier who's been providing them strips forever and say, hey, I just see these sensors start coming up. And unfortunately, within Medicare, the way the consolidated billing is established, if you're getting CGM, you cannot get your test strips billed by Medicare. So that's causing a problem for those people because
Now it's one
this
or the
company,
other.
They don't know, is sending CGM, never trained them on how to use it. It shows up. It's not prescribed by their doctor. It's by some random doctor that they've never heard of. And those are just stockpiling because they're continually, perpetually providing those and billing Medicare system. So there are some coordinated efforts that we're, as an industry, trying to put together some information to present to Medicare as well to help combat that unethical behavior. But it's one of those problems.
So that's why I wanted you to explain what it is, because the whole point is that there may be people getting continuous glucose monitoring devices who maybe aren't diabetic. Maybe some of these people don't want them because they're not technologically savvy. The Medicare population kind of, you know, runs the gambit. You know, I worked a number of cases that involve diabetic testing supplies, the meters and the strips. And, you know, the thing that always fascinated me about it was the money is not in the meter. The money is in the strips because of the proprietary nature of the strips. And I could talk for hours about some of the fraud schemes involving what's known as carouseling, the reselling of the strips on eBay and black market, and the fact that they're not serialized, there's no way to trace them, and that theoretically, payers, commercial, Medicaid, and Medicare, could be paying for the same box 3, 4, or 5 times because the box, you know, because of this stockpiling, and the fact that the beneficiary, the onus is on the beneficiary to tell the supplier, no, I'm not using you anymore. I'm using this one. And what there really is there's a race. There's a race to the finish line. So look, the PHE created a lot of great things. There's a lot of good that came out of it and that access to care and that continuity of care. But obviously those who are intent on, you know, engaging in fraud, waste, and really more fraud than waste and abuse are going to capitalize on that. And it's just really a matter of time, you know, until that kind of comes to a head. So, you know, we're kind of running out of time, and I know you mentioned brace yourself, and I do want to bring that up in another time with you because we're going to have you back to talk specifically about that. But I want to kind of give you the last word on this. With telemedicine being something that's going to, it's staying, right? There's some new rules about it. There's modifiers that have now been made permanent, modifier 95 for telemedicine related visits. I think we're going to start to see a continued growth and expansion in ancillary services like DME, and obviously we're seeing it big in the genetic testing world and other services. But I think there's going to be, and there is a place for DME as it relates to telemedicine. Where do you see, and being part of sort of the on the ground policy groups that are out there, where do you see some of the future of where DME is going to interact more in a positive way with telemedicine?
That's a very good question. And we've actually been having some conversations with the DME MACs about some of the policies have been relaxed to actually include languages such as telehealth. Before, the languages in the policies were strictly face-to-face. CGM is one, for example. The policy was just revised during the public health emergency. Prior to the revision, the follow-up visit and the initial visit had to be done in person. And now that policy was revised to include in-person or telehealth encounter. And so we're seeing this being sort of the trend in more and more policies where it's possible. Now, notwithstanding, I think the DME MACs are conscious of what products can be done and evaluated via telehealth. There are products that it requires an in-person visit, right, that you have to have one, like diabetic shoes, right? Or the knee braces that you're referring to. Well, you can't really do a joint laxity tests over FaceTime. It's just not a practical thing. So I think that though there's going to be some adoption. Obviously, you guys are familiar with the law that was passed by Congress that extends the flexibilities of telehealth until December 31st, 2024. I think that will give Congress and probably the CAC, the coverage analysis group, time to analyze the benefits of telehealth to see how it impacts. But I do see some positive thing for the purposes of DME. You know, I was talking to a very large healthcare system the other day, and they're telling us that their visit now with the flexibilities for telehealth for reevaluation of PAP patients is about 6 months out. And if those flexibilities were eliminated, that would extend it even further. Well, Medicare policy requires that that patient be reevaluated between the 31st and 90th day. So that the allowance of telehealth or the continual allowance of telehealth definitely will help bridge that gap, because what would end up happening is if there weren't these relaxed telehealth, these patients would just not get any supplies within that. If you remember the Part D donut analogy, because that's exactly where you would be, where Medicare won't pay for the item because you're not yet reevaluated. So allowing telehealth to fill those gaps while we work, because while we're out of the PHE, we're still having staffing issues, right? I mean, I know I still have opening positions. I see that you guys post them, likewise the doctors. So it doesn't just flip the switch on May 12 and all the problems go away. So allowing for the telehealth does allow for certain flexibilities. But coupled with that is we have to work together, stakeholders and the program integrity contractors, the MAC, to curtail the abuse, run data analysis to identify the new relationship, identify where there's no established relationship, no follow-up, things like that, and also look for the aberrancy in patterns, referrals across state lines, and referrals per doctor, per supplier. Those are all numbers and things that data that CMS has access to and impress upon the UPIC contractors, which I know that their resources are strained, and to try and do that. But, you know, I know our time is running out, but I would love to talk maybe on another session, Matt, about really making sure that the UPIC are able to identify the fraudulent providers so that they're not wasting their resources going after someone is a mom and pop that might just need some education, who could probably just refer for education and not necessarily go towards the full-blown suspension or termination, because with education, their heart is in the right place, versus someone who is deliberately opening up suppliers, putting them under people's name, jumping around, tricking the system because they know how to do so. So that would be an interesting conversation. I definitely have some thoughts on that, and I'd love to hear Jason and Matt's thoughts because of their perspective behind the scenes and the UPICs. But yeah, I think telehealth is going to be here for a little bit. I do believe there's a benefit. We just have to learn how to curtail the abuse like every other industry that we have to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of stuff, and we could really spend hours talking about all of these nuances and talk about the various interplay that comes in the post-PHE world, Operation Brace Yourself and all of those things. this was great. I really appreciate you coming on, Noel. We're going to set up a time to do some follow-ups because there's a lot to talk about, and people who join us on these podcasts are really interested in hearing some of these kind of nuanced areas. You have a level of granularity that I think most people in the fraud, waste, and abuse world don't necessarily understand. So it was great getting your perspective. I look forward to talking to you again, having you on again for another one of our sessions. I look forward to continuing our conversations on LinkedIn about some of the topics that we constantly are talking about. To everybody that joins on our podcast, we really appreciate it. As always, again, if you're not getting our newsletter, you can send an email to us at hello@advizehealth.com. We'll get you signed up for the newsletter. Our podcast will come to you in that newsletter. You can also get our podcasts on demand on our YouTube channel. You can also get them on Spotify. You can see all of our historical podcasts, our LinkedIn Lives. We've got one coming up in June. We're going to be doing a LinkedIn Live with Dr. Gary Cicio, podiatrist who's been in the industry for about 30 years, primarily in the fraud, waste, abuse world. We're going to have him on coming in June. So keep your eyes out and sign up for that one. We've got some spots left. We've got about 400 or 500 people already signed up. We expect to get a few more out of that. So as always, thank you for joining us. Jason, Matt, good to see you guys. As always, Noel, I'll catch you on the other side as well. Thanks for being on. Appreciate everybody's time. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you all. Bye.